Ambitious schedule today, but let me just, and we'll take it in the order that it's on the schedules. We're going to talk about Marine Reserves a little bit, and then we will do the three legislative concepts that we will adopt as committee bills this morning. We'll do the title transfer, Tualatin Project first, then the sesquicentennial farms resolution, and then finish up with the water supply grants program. And I'll just remind the committee, today's, and Dr. Lubchenco, if you want to come up and get set up while I'm rambling on here for a minute, that's fine. This is just one more in our series of bringing folks in that have been working on the Marine Reserves issue or that are widely considered in Oregon to have done great study or be experts on the issue, simply to continue educating our committee, because one way or another this issue will be before our committee. I want to make sure that we are as prepared as we possibly can be to handle it, because it's a complicated issue in many different ways. And so first today is Dr. Jane Lubchenco from Oregon State University. And if you could, before you start, remind the committee, you've been before the committee before, but remind us a little bit about your background, what you do at Oregon State University, and what you've done relative to this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with you today. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I've prepared, which includes a little bit of what you asked me to do, Mr. Chairman. But let me say simply that I've been teaching at Oregon State University for some 30 years now. My specialty is marine biology and environmental sciences. I teach and do research in Oregon, and am delighted to have spent as much time on the Oregon coast as I have. The purpose of my visit here is to focus on the science of marine reserves, because it is a topic of interest not only to the committee but to many people in the state of Oregon. And I come here as a scientist focusing on the science of marine reserves. My intent is to communicate the information that we know from having studied marine reserves various places around the world. The experience that I bring to this topic includes a number of different things. I've had the pleasure of leading an international team of scientists from many different countries that have synthesized the science of marine reserves. I lead a program of research and monitoring that is focused on the west coast of the U.S. It's called PISCO, the Partnership for Interdisciplinary Studies of Coastal Oceans. Along with our colleagues at other universities in California, we collectively seek to understand how the ecosystem off our coast works and is changing. I'm lucky to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences. I was a lead author on a recent international scientific assessment about the state of the world's ecosystems. And I served on the Pew Oceans Commission, which is one of the two major commissions that was charged with taking stock of the status of ocean in U.S. jurisdiction and what needs to be done to do a better job protecting and restoring our ocean ecosystems. And then I've been in Oregon for 30 years doing research along our coasts. So this is the experience that I bring to this particular topic, and it's a great pleasure to try to integrate and synthesize that as it's relevant to your deliberations. I want to focus my remarks on three different topics. What are marine reserves? Why are we discussing them? What is known about reserves, and how is this relevant to Oregon? Marine reserves are a particular type of marine protected area. So it's important that we are using, or that you know what I mean when I use particular language. So I'd like to just define these terms for us. Marine protected areas, commonly called MPAs, are areas of the ocean that are managed for some kind of conservation goal. Something is not allowed, and the intent of that is to achieve some conservation purpose. MPAs are a pretty broad category, and they include a whole range of different kinds of areas and different kinds of activities. You can think of them in along a spectrum of levels of protection. For example, this upper arrow on the figure here shows areas that have low protection all the way up to medium and high protection. Marine reserves are areas that have the highest protection because there's no extractive activity that is allowed in them. There are other types of MPAs that are very important for other kinds of reasons. They might be marine conservation areas, marine parks. Something is restricted, but some take is allowed in most MPAs. So to summarize that part of it, we define a marine reserve as an area of the ocean that is fully protected from any extractive or destructive activities on a permanent basis, except as needed to monitor or evaluate them. So again, marine reserves are a category of marine protected areas, and MPAs have some restrictions, but they vary considerably as to what they are. I think it's really important to note that until very, very recently, the ocean was full of marine reserves. There were vast areas of the ocean where it was too far away from land, too deep, or too rocky to do any extractive activities, to fish or to drill or to do anything else. And over time, humans have figured out very clever ways of getting farther and farther away from the coast and deeper and deeper. And the end result is that most of the ocean today is accessible, and there is extraction that happens in most of the ocean. Currently, less than 1% of the entire area of the ocean is in a reserve. That gives you a sense of how much of the ocean is protected, and it's very, very little. As we are beginning to appreciate that more and more of the ocean is being affected by human activities, people are beginning to think about using reserves as a tool to reestablish some of the protection that used to be there, but that is no longer. So the first topic that I laid out to discuss were what are marine reserves, and very simply, they're no-take areas. So why are we discussing them? I think two primary reasons why marine reserves are on people's radar screen. One, because ocean ecosystems and the livelihoods that depend upon them are currently being threatened. They're being threatened by a wide variety of activities, unsustainable rates of fishing, habitat destruction, pollution, climate change, and ocean acidification are chief among those. This conclusion that marine ecosystems are being threatened was reached by the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, by the Pew Oceans Commission, and by the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And so both scientific and policy bodies, both within the U.S. and internationally, are coming to the same conclusion. And they suggest that, in fact, things are changing, and they are changing in a way that is not good for marine species or the people that depend on them. This is an animation that I'd like to show you that was prepared for the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, this international scientific assessment of the state of the world's ecosystems. This figure takes the data that are collected by the UN Food and Agricultural Organization that are reported by every country of the world, and it puts it together and shows year by year by year, starting in 1950, going to 1999, where the peak areas of fishing are. And the white is where there is a pre-peak. The red that you'll see on this animation is where the harvest peak is. And the pink is where there has been sufficient extraction that the bulk of fishing activities has moved elsewhere. And so the pink is an area where there is probably some fishing remaining, but it's not as economically viable as it was. Some of those areas are recovering. Some appear to be permanently depleted. So the pink just means it's no longer peak fishing. So I'll start the animation. You can pick any area of the coast that you like and watch and see what happens through time. Keep your eye on the counter that's on the lower left. We're now up to 1975. 1980, 85, 90, 95, and up to the year 99. I'll let it run once more. Pick a different area of the coast, a different part of the world. And you can see pretty much the pattern that over this 50-year time span, fishing has moved farther and farther away from the coasts and farther south. Now, this is a global pattern, and these are global fisheries. But the real point of this is simply that fishing activities have now occur every place, and there is a significant impact of some of these fishing activities on the ecosystems in which the fish live. The second reason that we're talking about marine reserves, though, is that there's now a wealth of information and evidence about marine reserves synthesized from all around the world that tells us that marine reserves protect and restore both species and habitats, and they can provide resilience to ecosystems. They can make them less susceptible to very abrupt change, and they can make ecosystems more able to withstand various environmental changes as they happen. So the reason we're talking about marine reserves is that ocean ecosystems and the species in them and people who depend on them, those livelihoods, are all threatened. And the evidence shows that marine reserves work. So what is this evidence? What do we know about reserves? This document that has been provided to you is a synthesis of a lot of the information that we have about marine reserves. I'd like to hit some of the highlights of what we have learned. This information was compiled by a group of authors from around the world and was just recently published, so this is pretty much hot off the press. I know that when Dr. Hickson was here, he talked about some of this research and its conclusions and information that is being broadly used by people not only in Oregon but around the world, because it really is very comprehensive and synthetic. This project looked at marine reserves from 124 reserves where scientific studies had been done on the reserves, and so we can evaluate what happened in the reserves. How did things change? And we can evaluate, in some cases, what happened outside the reserve. We studied 124 reserves in 29 countries, and the red dots on this map show you where those studies were. So it's pretty much every place. Although not Oregon. You will note an absence. Those red dots there are from Washington and California that are along the West Coast. Okay, so what happens? What did we find about what happens when a marine reserve is established? What happens is when there is no longer any extractive activity, it's not surprising that things get much more abundant, they get bigger, they get more diverse inside a reserve. And the data that you see here is a synthesis of that information. What you see plotted is the percent change in some biological measure, for example, biomass, that's some total amount of stuff that's in the reserve. And on average, when a reserve was established, there was an increase in biomass of over 400%. So that's a huge increase. Imagine the biomass in this room, the collective amount of humans that are in this room, increasing by over 400%. That would be a very big change. The density is increasing by, on average, 166%. The individual size of organisms increases, as does their diversity. Now, there's a lot more potential for biomass and density to increase, but all of these are significant. The black dots show you the individual reserves where studies were done, and most of those are positive. There are a few black dots that are negative, so in a few reserves around the world, something different happened. And usually what happens is, for example, if predators are now becoming very abundant in a reserve because they are no longer fished, then their prey become less abundant. So that's the reason for some of those negative numbers. That probably indicates that the balance of interactions in the system was being restored. So on average, marine reserves work in the sense that there are huge changes that happen inside them. Species are protected and habitats are protected. These changes...
Before you move on, are you going to get... Do you have slides after this that get to the changes outside of the reserve?
Yes, I do, Senator.
Okay. And let me ask you one thing about diversity. Does the diversity increase because you've got species from outside the reserve that then move into the reserve? Or is it also that species that are inside the reserve are able to survive when maybe they otherwise wouldn't have?
The increase in diversity is probably due to two things. One, they may have been rare enough before. They may have been there, but they were too rare to count. You typically, when studies are done, you do transects or some way of censusing a population, and you may have missed something. So they're more abundant, and so they're more obvious. But it's most likely that there are species from the outside that now are protected, and so they are becoming more abundant. So that most of the increase in diversity is likely new things coming into that system. And thank you for... posing any questions as they arise. That's probably easier to do as we're going through these. One thing that we were curious about was whether there were differences in the performance of marine reserves in temperate versus tropical areas inside a reserve. And this figure shows that temperate areas, that reserves have fairly similar performance in both kinds of areas. If anything, they are more powerful in temperate areas than in tropical areas. There's a slightly greater increase in biomass and in density in temperate areas. So tropical areas of the world are obviously those in the tropics, usually between 20 degrees north and 20 degrees south latitude. Temperate areas are between that and the more polar or boreal areas. So we are obviously in a temperate area, and that's why this is relevant to our considerations. Another finding of the marine reserve information is that not all species respond equally quickly to the establishment of protection. Some species recover very, very quickly. Others take a long time. These are data from one of the longest marine reserves in the world. This particular one is from Kenya. And I show it simply because it shows two different species that have recovered at very different rates. The blue line shows the recovery of parrotfish that have increased very significantly over about a 10-year period of time and then leveled off. In contrast to that, surgeon fish, different type of fish, increased very, very slowly over time, but are continuing to increase even after almost 40 years of protection. So the point here is simply that not all species do the same thing, which is not surprising, but it's good to have quantitative information that documents that. How fast they recover depends in part on how quickly they grow, how many offspring they produce, and those that grow fast and have lots of offspring typically recover faster. You asked, Mr. Chairman, about what happens outside a reserve. This is one of the results. When a reserve is established, because species are becoming more abundant, more diverse, more crowded, larger inside the reserve, some of what is inside the reserve spills out to adjacent areas. And this is simply called spillover. The information that we have to document that comes from species that are tagged inside a reserve and then later caught outside the reserve. So these are data from three different places in the world where fishes were tagged inside a reserve, and what's shown here are the distances that those fish were caught outside the reserve. So we know they were in the reserve, they grew up, they moved outside and were caught. In Florida, for example, at the Merritt Island Reserve, the recreational fishermen who were initially strongly opposed to the creation of this marine reserve are now great fans of it because they are getting world record catches from fish that are growing up inside the reserve and then swimming outside. And so this is providing a bonus. This is recharging areas outside. The reserve is acting to not only protect species and habitats inside, but to provide some benefit outside. Now, this spillover effect is likely to only have an impact in the immediate area around the reserve, not very far away. So its potential to have significant benefit in recovering depleted fisheries, for example, is somewhat limited. The other kind of impact that marine reserves can have outside an area is by virtue of protecting what we call the big old fat female fish, the boss. And these big old fat females, when they get very, very large, their reproductive potential is immense. Even if they stay in the reserve, when they reproduce, that those offspring are transported oftentimes in ocean currents outside of the area. And so this is thought to be the greatest potential benefit for areas outside the reserve. As you can imagine, this is very difficult to document because you can't tag all those little tiny larvae or eggs that are being produced. So the information that we have from this comes from indirect evidence of studies where there have been increases outside and from modeling studies commonly used by fishery biologists that evaluate what the impact to the fish population is of larger individuals having many more young.
Is there any difference in the strength or the viability of the young from a bigger, healthier fish than one that isn't?
That's an area where we have insufficient information. There were some early studies that suggested that older mothers produce more fit young, but that's only known, has only been shown for one species so far, and people are actively looking into that to see if it's true. If so, it would be an added bonus, but we don't have enough information to say that conclusively yet. This increase in size producing more young is a really key point. And I'll use this slide of vermilion rockfish to illustrate it. On the left in red, you see about a 15-inch vermilion rockfish. That individual produces about 150,000 young. If you let that 15-inch rockfish grow to 24 inches, which is not at all unusual inside a reserve for them to grow to that size or even larger, a 24-inch vermilion rockfish produces 1.7 million young. So a little bit larger size means hugely larger reproductive output. Now, not all of those young survive, but when you have that many more out there, a much larger fraction of them are likely to survive. So this benefit of the boss, the big old fat female fish, is thought to be a very important key to potential benefit outside of a marine reserve. If we look at some of the rockfish that are along the west coast, there are a number that grow relatively slowly and that live to ripe old ages of 40, 50, 60, up to 120 years old. These are more slow-growing long-lived species. They are much more like humans in terms of their lifespan than we tend to think of many marine species. So these are some of the species for which there is concern that would have the potential to benefit from reserves, although probably not immediately. These are because they're slow growing. They would probably not benefit immediately from protection. So I've covered the first three topics now and would like to segue to how is this relevant to Oregon. I want to summarize what is known about reserves. The evidence that we have shows that marine reserves unequivocally protect habitats and protect species. There's no dissension about that. There's very hard, concrete, lots and lots of evidence. So they protect biodiversity and ecosystems. They're very, very good at doing that. There's also good evidence that they provide spillover of juveniles and adults to the immediate area outside. and they have the potential to provide export of larvae, especially when the individuals in the reserves are getting really big. They can also protect these big old fat female fish, which are important for other reasons, in addition to the export phenomenon. In addition to that, though, logic suggests that reserves can also provide insurance. We have areas that are protected and are functioning that are better able to withstand, are they more resilient to environmental changes, and provide scientific reference areas so that we know what the consequences of various activities outside are, because we have something against which to evaluate them. They clearly provide recreation value and educational value. So that's sort of the sum total of what the evidence shows and what logic suggests are the consequences of reserves. A new key concept has arisen, and that is not just a single reserve, but a network of reserves. A network is defined as an integrated set of reserves, not just some random collection, but ones that are actually connected by the movement of young or adults. And so larvae can hopscotch from one to another and be protected inside. Adults can be protected inside. If the adults go outside, then they're fished. So a network of reserves is now the current scientific sort of state-of-the-art of reserves is about networks, and it's because it allows the interspersion of protection and use in a way that is much more socially acceptable than having just a huge, large area that is protected. There's much more displacement, there's much more angst, there's much more concern about the social and economic implications of a single large one. And so reserves, networks of reserves, are pretty much where people are focusing their energies these days. There are a number of networks that have been established in the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, the Channel Islands off the coast of Australia, and off the California coast. There are now networks of marine reserves that have been designed to function as networks. I want to issue a note of caution here. Marine reserves are not a panacea. They're not going to accomplish everything that is a threat to oceans. They're not going to take those threats away. Other tools are really important to use in conjunction with marine reserves. Good fishery management, pollution control, smart coastal development are some of those. So this is one more tool in the toolbox that we have. So we've talked about what are marine reserves, why we're talking about them, what's known, and I want to move now to why reserves are relevant to Oregon. We have no marine reserves in Oregon. We have a number of marine protected areas that are doing very important things and that are good. Our statewide planning goal 19 focuses on conserving marine resources and ecological functions. That is exactly what marine reserves are all about. And so to adequately achieve goal 19, marine reserves are a very appropriate tool. I'm sure you're aware of the discussions that the Ocean Policy Advisory Council has been having over the years. In 2002, OPAC recommended that the governor establish a limited system of marine reserves. Governor Kulongoski asked OPAC in 2005 to recommend steps to do that, and the current OPAC is deliberating about this very topic. I would emphasize that over 70 of the marine reserves that we studied in this synthesis are from temperate areas, and that many of those temperate areas are actually very similar to Oregon in terms of the types of species and the types of ecosystems. And so even though we don't have reserves in Oregon to see how they would do in Oregon, we can look elsewhere in the world and get information from these other places where reserves or networks are in place. I don't believe there's any reason to think that Oregon reserves would behave differently from those in other similar types of ecosystems. We have similar species, similar oceanography, similar habitats, similar ecosystems, and similar ecological and oceanographic dynamics. And that's part of what we as ecological scientists do, is see what's similar and different about ecosystems. And so I think there's good reason to believe that our reserves would perform in a similar fashion. There have been a lot of lessons learned about establishing networks of marine reserves, not just what happens when you do them, but how to do them. And a lot of social scientists now are getting involved in providing guidance about the best ways to have the social discussions. And the information that's coming from those syntheses of social science information is telling us that it's important to have clear goals. What is it that you want from a reserve or a network of reserves or a system? Clear authority, who's in charge and who has the legal responsibility and authority. To involve stakeholders, public participation is critically important. There needs to be a credible process for making decisions that's open, transparent, participatory. There needs to be a clear process for using scientific information in the process, and adequate funding for that process to happen, for those public meetings, but then once reserves are established, for the evaluation and monitoring. And in addition to thinking about networks of reserves, I think it's smart to couple networks of reserves and marine protected areas. They serve different functions and should be thought of as a package. So I think this is relevant to Oregon, in short, because most of Oregon's marine habitats and species are not protected. And the evidence suggests that if we want to protect them, if we want to restore areas that are or have been degraded, then marine reserves are an important tool to do so, although not the only one. So the information that's in this booklet includes more of the specifics along with references, and I would be happy to answer any questions about this or related topics, and I thank the committee very much for the opportunity to provide this information.
Anything?
Question?
Yeah. Senator Bates?
Well, thank you. Thanks for your presentation this morning. I would ask if you could to get our staff for some hard data about what's really happening in the coast of Oregon. I really don't know, and I think a lot of people are kind of confused by it. I follow the salmon runs pretty carefully, and the steelhead runs pretty carefully. I know that we're having difficulty there. But as far as the marine habitat, I don't really know that much about what's going on. I'd like to have hard data about it. What's our catches looking like? What's our biomass looking like in various species? How much information do we really have about what the problem is? That would be more meaningful to me. If you get the information to our staffer, I'd appreciate that. I expect that's going to be kind of detailed and minute, but I'd really like to look at that.
Thank you, Senator. There are there's good information for some of the species that are economically important. And the information that we have for a lot of other species in the system is pretty dispersed, and people are in the process of trying to pull a lot of that together. And it's something that really needs to be done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Before you go, I just wanted to welcome, I see, Representatives Krieger, Cowan, and Roblin. So welcome, and you are more than welcome to join us at the dais. I don't know if you heard me. You're welcome to join us at the dais if you would like to.
They may not want to associate with us today, but come on up anyway.
Senator Nelson, did you have something?
No.
I wonder if you could, I guess two thoughts I have. One of them is, are there any particular species off the Oregon coast that you think would benefit? I mean, you hear, I know that there's been discussion about rockfish in other hearings, and I've read things about this, so I wonder if in particular there are some. And then the other is, Could you give us some kind of a notion of what happens to the Oregon coast if we don't do anything, or if we do something inadequate? Because I don't know how to gauge that.
The Pew Oceans Commission looked at changes that are happening within U.S. waters all around the country, and found that, in fact, there has been significant loss of biological diversity. There has been inability of marine ecosystems to provide many of the services that people want, controlling outbreaks of pests and pathogens, for example, or cleaning up, absorbing toxic pollutants, for example, and also providing fish and seafood. Those kinds of services tend often to be linked to the types of habitats and the connection among those habitats and many species in the systems that aren't particularly thought or known to be important directly to people. They're indirectly important because they're part of the functioning of the ecosystem. And many of the different habitat formers, many of the smaller species that are prey, all of those species interact together and collectively are providing the services that we want. Seafood, protection of shores against coastal erosion that kelp forests provide, et cetera, those kinds of things. And so what is happening over time is a slow degradation of the system that is often not obvious until some disaster happens and then the system can't recover. And those are the kinds of things that are being seen around the country and around the world. So doing nothing is probably a sure bet for bad things happening down the road. Protecting the habitats, protecting the species, protecting the functioning of the system is a good way to ensure that the services that we have now continue. We can't assume that they're always going to be there because things are changing. There are a number of invasive species, a lot of other things that are happening, and it happens relatively slowly over time, and so people sort of aren't paying attention, and all of a sudden the things that we want or need have disappeared.
Doctor, thank you very much. Appreciate your time with the committee this morning. Do you need just a minute to get your computer and everything? Why don't you take your time? I'll tell you what, committee, we'll just stand at ease for about 3 minutes, let the doctor wrap her stuff up. And then when we come back, Louise Soliday and Patty Burke.
Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Our office is in Newport. And Dr. Lubchenco covered a number of things I was going to cover, so I know your time constraints, so I'll try to go fairly quickly. And like she did, if there are questions as I go along, slow me down. Louise Soliday is here, too. Do you want to?
Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands.
And we will tag team this to save time as well.
Perfect.
The what is a marine reserve was covered. I'm going to focus for the committee on what's really going on in Oregon and how these might need, what process these will go through in order to be implemented. Current marine protected areas in Oregon, as you heard, are within the territorial sea. This map shows a thin pink line out to the blue is U.S. waters off of Oregon. What we're talking about are siting these within the territorial sea, which is shore to 3 miles, more or less. Louise, did you want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just so everybody understands clearly what the territorial sea is and how the State Land Board and the Department of State Lands figure into the territorial sea. Under ORS 196-405 sub 5, the territorial sea is defined as the waters and seabed extending 3 geographical miles seaward from the coastline in conformance with federal law. And just so everybody understands, a geographical mile or a nautical mile is not the same as a mile that we drive in our car. It's actually a little longer. It's 1.15 miles that we drive. So you're actually talking about out 3.45 miles. And the coastline includes the islands and the rocks. So you'll see areas. I've attached a map to my testimony. You'll see areas where that line bumps out wider than other areas, and that's because we have islands and rocks, and the line moving out starts at the baseline of those islands or rocky complexes that we have off of our coast. ORS 274710 sub 1 grants the department exclusive jurisdiction over all the ungranted title submerged lands owned by the state, and this includes the territorial sea. That exclusive jurisdiction is a proprietary jurisdiction, not a regulatory jurisdiction. So while we as a department have regulatory authority with regard to removal fill permitting in the territorial sea, there are lots of other agencies, and we'll talk about that a little later, who also have regulatory responsibilities out there. As a result of the land board having jurisdiction over the territorial sea, those lands are considered what we call statutory lands as opposed to constitutional lands. Constitutional lands having been granted to the department to generate revenue for schools exclusively. The statutory lands give us some more flexibility, and the Constitution directs the land board to manage those lands under its jurisdiction with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of the state, consistent with conservation of the resource under sound techniques of land management. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Patty, and I'll come back in a little later.
And to catch you up on your slides, we're on slide 9 now. So what's going on in Oregon in more detail? The areas that we call marine protected areas that have been designated for a long time in Oregon, some since the 1960s. And they're both subtitle and intertidal, but they're all very close to shore. Subtitle just means that it never is exposed, and intertidal means there's an exposure of the bottom to the air once in a while. The current marine protected areas, we have 14, one of which is the most restricted, and it has no commercial or sport fishing for fish or invertebrates, but there is sport kelp harvest there. The reason for these, and the next slide shows you where they are, historically there was a significant driver was to try to find areas where there might be overharvest of shellfish and intertidal species, and that was one of the drivers for these. Some of them are research reserves and allow for only research take. Some allow for fishing other than shellfish, and so that's what an MPA is. It has some restrictions, but it doesn't prohibit all take. And as you can see, they're scattered up and down the coast. Each one of them is small, very small. You wouldn't be talking about many square miles here, if even one square mile.
You got to go back to sport kelp harvest for me, because
you guys ever hear this?
Yeah, they're real fighters. You know, one of those babies, man, you got to fight your hands.
I'm sorry.
Evidently, Senator Nelson, who's the furthest away from the coast of all of us up here, he knows what it is, but we don't. People actually get a license for this, and they go out and get kelp.
Mr. Chair, apparently this isn't regulated by ODFW, and I believe Louise's agency actually has a role in it. And maybe you want to address this one.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, our statutes allow us to lease areas of the territorial sea for the purposes of harvesting kelp, and people are allowed to, for personal consumption, take up to 2,000 pounds of kelp each year.
People explain what kelp is. So
people eat it.
And Mr. Chair, and Senator Nelson, kelp is a large algae that grows in the ocean. When you're walking on the beach and you trip over what looks like a long rope with a ball at the end, that's some of the kelp species that we have.
Thanks, Senator Nelson. I knew what it was. I just didn't know people went out.
We're talking about, you know, going out and fishing for
it. No. All right.
I mean, don't you take it in pills? I buy it at a natural food place.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The science of marine reserves in Oregon, and I'll just mention these are two of our commissioners on a out at sea with us on a research trip to tag black rockfish, which is one of the ways we're trying to create assessment tools. There are things that we know about the Oregon Territorial Sea. The oceanography of the area is relatively well characterized. However, the habitats are poorly characterized, and Senator Bates was asking kind of what we know and what we don't know. Only about 5% of the state waters have been mapped. And so when we're talking about citing marine reserves, that's one of the significant handicaps we have, is that we don't have the data in hand in detail on habitats. And so that's why we'll talk later about why we're using a public nomination process for marine reserves. We need the expertise of the people that are on the water and fish and know where these areas are. Kelp surveys and mapping we have. Rocky intertidal information is relatively well characterized. Seabird nesting colonies in Oregon are documented. And we, of course, document the pinniped or the seal and sea lion haulouts on our coast. That's what we know. This is an example of the detailed habitat mapping we're talking about, bathymetric habitat mapping. And as you can see, this would be something you can't do overnight coastwide. And we definitely need resources to get the territorial sea mapped adequately. It's a tool that's extremely valuable. This is where we have our problem, the general unknowns. The detail of benthic habitats, as I said, is not there. We don't know coastwide hot spots for fish larvae and recruitment. We don't understand the life stages, behavior, and physiology of many of these species that we're managing. Nursery areas for different species, food web relationships, hot spots for biodiversity. Population status of 35 ground species is not assessed. We have about 43 species in territorial sea, and about 35 of them are not assessed. The population status, as I said, of unharvested species is unknown. So one of the main reasons we would want to look at marine reserves is because of all of the things we don't know. It's not easy to manage fisheries when you don't know this much about the environment they're in. This is the status of the assessed and not assessed species. We have about 43 species, as I said. Only 8 of them have been assessed, and of those, 2 are depleted. And I believe somebody asked, one of the senators asked about the species movement. A canary rockfish we're finding with our telemetry work is a very mobile rockfish, whereas the yellow-eye rockfish is more sedentary. And so this is an example where marine reserves might be very helpful for yellow-eye rockfish recovery. It may not be as helpful for canary rockfish recovery, and that's why Dr. Lubchenco was emphasizing that this isn't a one-size-fits-all solution for the ocean, but it does have a niche.
What's the process for deciding what species you're going to assess and which you're not?
Mr. Chair, this is mostly driven by the Federal Pacific Fishery Management Council, covering the whole West Coast. Each state contributes science, data, and scientists, but the stock assessments are generally funded by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And so the drivers for which species are generally biased towards the ones that are harvested that we may have concerns about. But some of the non-assessed species are in that category. It's just that we don't have enough data to have a stock assessment on them. So we need age data. We need a lot of information.
So we don't know that there might be other species that would fit that canary and yellow eye depleted category. We just don't know.
Mr. Chair, yes. And that's the challenge of trying to manage fisheries in this environment and why a precautionary tool is useful. So the thing that
I want to make sure I understood what you just said. Mm-hmm. When you said that's why precautionary tools would be helpful, are you talking about marine reserves as a precautionary tool?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so you would err on the side of implementing something precautionary in the absence of the data.
Mr. Chair, as you know, we have a we have a Oregon native fish conservation policy that isn't just about salmon. We also use it for the species we manage in the ocean. And what you just stated, absent data, we should be taking precautionary approaches is part of that policy.
Okay, thank you.
So the current regulatory framework is what we'll hear about from people that have concerns about this because it's very complex. It's designed to deal with the mixed stock. And you'll hear people who are opposed to marine reserves talking about the fact that we are already overregulated. And there is a lot of place-based management in the ocean. We also don't have any tools in place that exclude all harvests and all gear. We do have different versions of that, however. And this next slide shows you areas that have been protected through the Pacific Fishery Management Council for essential fish habitat for groundfish. But these are not protected for all gear types and all fisheries. Some of these are no-trawl areas. The areas that are red are pinnacles. Those are no bottom contact. So if you're going over it, you may fish over it as long as you're not contacting the bottom regulations. And again, you can see on the far right there, the territorial sea is the thin strip right next to the coast. But when we talk with people that are ocean users, they look at things like this and they say, we have all these area-based closures. The yellow is a year-round rockfish conservation closure. And that means there can't be any bottom trawl in those areas during parts or all of the year. Those are regulations that are designed to help some of these depleted stocks recover. And so if you have a fishing gear that will allow the depleted species to not be harmed, you can fish in that area. And so you may have bottom trawl for shrimp in an area that's closed for other bottom trawl, because the bottom trawl for shrimp allows rockfish to escape through an escape hatch in their nets. So this is the part that's complicated. Our regulations are very space-based, and we're trying to manage a mixed stock in a very complicated setting here. But if the goal is to protect habitat from being contacted by gear, you're going to do different things than if your goal is to try to preserve and enhance a species that's depleted. So bottom contact gear is a good example. If you're going to allow gear that touches the bottom, as long as it lets rockfish escape, that's not necessarily a habitat protection. It's a fishery rebuilding strategy. So although we have a lot of place-based regulations, they're not designed to protect habitat per se. And one of the niches that Marine Reserves has is it would be something that's focused on protecting habitat. However, I think that in the process, it helps to recognize the many different regulations the fisheries have that are place-based, because I think the fishing community feels like that isn't understood. If we look at the small strip of territorial sea, and then you look at the comp, and this is one of several maps that I can show you of different space-based regulations. I think the people that are ocean users want this kind of perspective to be in the mix when these decisions are made. And so I think that's the reason we put these maps together.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm following you still. It sounds like we already have some precautionary tools. We've got this rockfish conservation area. We've got some marine protected areas. But what I hear you saying is that it's better for those depleted species and habitat in general if you have something like a marine reserve as a tool in addition to these things.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
And as we've been talking, the lack of information drives the use of a precautionary tool such as reserves. Setting aside areas of special habitat for mixed stock species is going to be helpful for this tool. But as I said, it's going to be most helpful for sedentary species. If you have species that are flying through from California to Canada each year, probably there might be a life stage that would benefit from a marine reserve, but that whole the whole life cycle is not going to be affected by a marine reserves. So it's important to be very specific about the goal of a marine reserve, because we wouldn't want them interpreted as being, you know, solutions for everything. And another big use for marine reserves is a scientific one, to have reference areas where there's no fishing so that we can see some of the comparisons with our fishing areas. We don't have that now. The desired outcomes for reserves can be many. Generally, they're habitat-focused, but the outcomes vary depending on what you measure, where you put them, the size, and the scope, and most importantly, as what is the level of support for the research, enforcement, and monitoring. If we have marine reserves and they're not enforced, they don't mean much if the regulations are being violated. If we can't fund studying them, people wonder, why do we have them if we're not looking at what they do? So the desired outcomes for reserves are contingent on a lot of other things, including what you decide to measure and what your goals are for the reserves. Dr. Lubchenco went over lessons learned, so I'm going to skip over that and get into the Oregon process. You're familiar with the Ocean Policy Advisory Committee, so I won't spend much time on that. But recently, the governor met with fishermen in November and put some margins around this process. He said that the OPAC recommendation should be for less than 10 no-take reserve sites, that they should be large enough to provide for scientific testing and the ecological benefits they might produce, but small enough to avoid economic and social impacts, such as the loss of significant fishing opportunities. Ed Bowles was scheduled to be here, the Fish Division Administrator for ODFW. He's with the Governor's Chief of Staff right now, going down the coast to talk about this and what this means to the Governor, and have the Governor hear what coastal people have as a reaction to this and the process. He also has committed that he won't advocate for implementation, which would be what the agencies do, until funding is identified for enforcement and implementation and monitoring of marine reserves. The authority of the Fish and Wildlife Commission and our role in the process is hand in glove with the Department of State Lands, and Louise will talk a little bit about the authorities. No one agency has authority to implement a marine reserve in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so there are multiple agencies who have various regulatory authorities in the territorial sea, and we received advice from the Attorney General's office last year that laid out the various roles and responsibilities and authorities of the various state agencies and federal entities within the territorial sea. And there are a number of state agencies listed there, as well as others who have various authorities. And so the advice to my agency and all of the agencies that are covered in that advice is that in order for marine reserves to be adopted and implemented in Oregon, it would take a number of agencies taking action through their various rulemaking processes. So in the case of the Department of State Lands, we would anticipate, and we are, I think it's important to point out, we are waiting for OPAC to complete its process and to bring forward a recommendation to the agencies. And once we have that, our agency and other agencies who are needed will go through a rulemaking process. We would, as the State Land Board, would do the actual designations. The other agencies would implement various regulatory restrictions in order to make those truly no-take marine reserves. And so I would anticipate that, assuming we get the recommendation from OPAC
this fall, that we will be in a rulemaking posture in early mid-2009 as we move that recommendation forward to implementation.
Thanks, Louise. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's role is to, at this time, support OPAC by participating. We're non-voting members, as are all the agencies and their governor's marine cabinet, provide information, briefing our commission, and coordinate with the other agencies, as well as participate in the public outreach. The statute specifically recommends that that marine protected areas be approved through this Fish and Wildlife Commission. So basically, Department of State Lands draws the lines, and then the Fish and Wildlife Commission will establish the fishery regulations that apply to each of those areas. There are lots of authorities that we have to do this work. The Magnuson-Stevens Conservation Act is the federal overlay for fisheries management. We have a food fish management policy that requires us to balance not only sport and commercial access, but also the economics of our regulations, as well as trying to focus on what it would take to prevent the extinction of any species. So it's a very complicated agenda there to meet all of those tasks. But the commission needs to reflect on all of those. And, of course, we have harvest regulations for sport and commercial fisheries, which drive the decisions. We talked about the native fish conservation policy. We also would fall under the ocean policy as well. And, Mr. Chair, that is our quick overview of the agency roles, and we welcome any questions from the committee.
Anything? Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good discussion. I appreciate your testimony. The testimony. It seems to me that we need to balance this thing. I mean, we have a lot of unknowns out here. We don't know what's going on, and we're just talking about, well, the conservation part of it. I think for the balance, we need to put into this economic benefits development. I was interested to read from the statement from the statute that Louise talked about, is that under the laws to do this land or to maintain this land with the greatest benefit of the people for the state. And what I see as an overall picture for all of our committees is that our number one problem in the state of Oregon is not really what's going on in the ocean. Our number one problem is, how do we fund public services? Where do we get the money? And the greatest benefit of to the state is probably students, the greatest number. Say maybe there's 40,000 environmentalists, but there's 600,000 K-12 students. There's, you know, in my district, I have two prisons out there. Those folks are, we don't have enough people manning our prisons. There are people out there that we're going to need money and funds. And what I see in this whole situation is, we can't even pass a cigarette tax in the state of Oregon. So how are we going to fund these public programs for the benefit of all the people? And what we are is a natural resource state. And I don't think we're looking at the Pacific Ocean. We're not using that to its fullest benefit. I don't think we're using our federal forests to our fullest benefit. I don't think we're using the Columbia River to our federal. And I think all those things together should be directed towards, you know, our biggest problem we have in the state of Oregon is, how do we fund public services? And where does this fit into this whole picture? You know, it's all going to come down to money, is what I'm seeing. So what I guess I'm suggesting is, okay, we have the reserves, we have the MPAs. I think we also could you create a situation where you have reserves for some sort of economic benefit dedicated to public education or health care or to public safety? And I don't see that that's all part of it. I think all this committee is just doing is focusing upon, well, we're assuming that maybe there's some economic or some environmental degradation going out there, but we really don't know. There's too many unknowns. And so, you know, I'm very intrigued by this idea of the marine reserves, but I think you also have to have some balance. So is there a possibility of other reserves where we actually go out and see if maybe we go out and develop some new source of that will replace fuel? There's a thing called methane hydrate that's abundant in the ocean. But some people are talking about, you know, this could be a solution for our greenhouse gas problem. is this going to prevent us from going out and trying to do something on these things? I mean, I think we have to look, you know, not take sides, and I sort of feel like we're taking sides in this thing, and we ought to spread it out in a much greater thing. So that's kind of how I'm looking at this thing right at the moment. I agree with Senator Bates. I think we need more information. I see you've got some folks here, some fishermen who don't think this is a very good idea yet. So there's a lot of opposition out there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, a couple things in response to that. At the same time that we're having this conversation about marine reserves, we are also looking at new technology in the ocean, and that's wave energy. And as you know, the revenue that comes into the Department of State Lands is common school fund revenues, which does generate revenue to fund public education. And this biennium, we predicted that we would probably distribute something in the order of $100 million to school districts. And it's not chump change. It's a significant amount of revenues that we're able to generate and drive out to the school districts. Wave energy is a new opportunity for us to generate revenue. It brings the same concerns to the coastal communities and the fishing communities, and that is how it affects other economic uses of the territorial sea. And so we have to look at those proposed projects in relationship to other uses that are going on out there and try to bring some balance to that. But I think there are other economic opportunities within the territorial sea that may have the opportunity to generate revenue. The other thing I'd say is I think what James folks are finding around the world is that because of the spillover benefits, there actually can be economic benefits that come from these marine reserves. While you are closing relatively small areas of, given the space of the ocean in the world, there are benefits that come in those spillover areas that lead to enhanced fishing opportunities. And I think there are some folks who are looking at this marine reserve issue as a way to maybe begin to pull back some of the fishing restrictions that we have, where we are closing huge areas to fishing in order to protect weak stocks. And as a result, we're not allowing fishing on some stocks that we might otherwise be able to fish on. And so maybe putting this tool in the toolbox might allow us to actually open up some areas of the ocean, probably not in the short term, but in the long term, to fishing that are now restricted to a lot of types of fishing in order to protect the weak stocks.
I wonder if you could talk just a little bit more about the first part of Senator Nelson's question, which I think you were just getting to, which is, what is degrading on the Oregon coast that has caused the executive branch to go so far along this path of marine reserves already?
Mr. Chair, I think there are a number of concerns. I think there certainly the fishing concerns are a driver in this. You know, we've been going from one fishing crisis to another over the last several decades. We had ground fish crisis in 2000. We had a salmon crisis last year. So while we continue to have a very conservative fish management regime off the West Coast, we continue to see crises occur in our fish stocks. I think there are growing concerns about pollution coming out of our watersheds into our ocean. I think a lot of people will tell you Oregon's ocean relative off the coast of Oregon relative to others may be in better shape, but I think there are continuing concerns, particularly as we have more development along our coast. I think those concerns will continue. I think there are concerns about habitat degradation that came from various fishing types. I want to give a lot of credit to our fishing community, who's done a lot in terms of changing their gear and gear types that they're using out there to try and minimize the bycatch impacts, the impacts on bottom habitat. So I think we're doing some things to address some of those concerns, but I think we've got climate change coming at us. We know that that's going to have a direct impact on the ocean and the ocean resources, and so I think having this precautionary tool in the toolbox makes a lot of sense.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, we don't necessarily agree on all of those points. I don't believe that marine reserves is going to, if we have 10 relatively small marine reserves up and
right
down the coast, that all of the things Louise talked about will be addressed. And as I said, in a mixed stock fishery, we could have one species that moves around a lot that limits all the stocks
and you can have 100 marine reserves, and if that species is not being protected, it still might limit all of the conditions you have on your regulations. My feeling about marine reserves is that if somebody asked me, are we doing a good job managing the ocean fisheries, I'd like to think we do, but I don't know. And I believe that not knowing is something where you want to apply as many tools as you can that will help you learn more. So if marine reserves are going to help us learn more about our effectiveness in managing the ocean, if marine reserves are going to provide habitat that otherwise might be affected by fishing or other uses, so that we can see what benefits accrue from that in addition to what we believe will accrue from that, those are the things that I think immediately can justify marine reserves. I don't believe we have an emergency on our coast. I don't believe that the closures should be a sign that we are restrictively regulating our fisheries. But the nature of our fishery is one in which marine reserves by themselves is not going to solve the problem. So it's as everybody is saying, it's a tool in the toolbox. It's a valuable tool that we're not using. And I believe there's a purpose for the tool. But it's hard to convince people who are ocean users that this is a good idea if we overpromise on this. And I don't think we need to. I think it's a good tool, and it has a niche, and Oregon should be using it.
Senator Bates?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be the wrong group to ask this question to, but I'd like to have a little more information about OPAC. They obviously, from what everyone sort of referenced in this morning, are doing a lot of discussion about this and probably some study and probably in greater depth than we can here in committee. They're not here to speak today, I don't think. I'd like to know a little bit about what their makeup is, who they represent, what constituencies they have on the committee, and what their discussions have been like, not only about marine reserves, but about the entire management of the ocean. We're looking at a worldwide crisis in the ocean, we know that. Oregon, I think, has been spared a great deal of that so far. But I'd like to hear a little bit about what OPAC's doing, and I'd really like to see what their findings are. You talked about them being those findings being available, recommendations this fall, I think. And I'd like to see if we can get those out earlier, because we're going to be in session in January and be talking about this, and we'd only be talking about it in May and June of next session.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, all good points. OPEC was changed several years ago. It used to be advisory to the governor. The voting members were state agency people. Representative Krieger had a bill that made the state agency people non-voting members. The other members are now voting members, and they constitute representatives from the counties, the ports, fishing sectors, environmental groups, pretty much the spectrum of people that are involved in the issues. OPAC in and of itself is not generating data. OPAC is not funded in general. And so what we're doing is trying to get the state agencies to provide information to the coastal experts who are on OPAC so that we can try to get advice back that will allow us to make better decisions on regulations. Right now, OPAC's looking at marine reserves. We have a subcommittee working on wave energy. We have a group looking at the National Aquaculture Bill, and we have a group looking at amending the Territorial Sea Plan. So for a voluntary group and a group of people that are very busy in their real lives, we're very fortunate that we have the members of the coastal community doing this work, because it's not easy, and all those issues are tough issues.
Senator B, by the time we get to the 09 session, we will have OPEC in here, and we've had them in once before, just very, very briefly, but we'll have them in much more to go through the process that they've gone through.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, anything else, committee? All right, well, thank you both very much. Appreciate your time this morning. We are going to go through the other three topics, since that's all we have left today, and so that we can break before lunch and not have to come back. And we will start with Legislative Concept 26. Commissioner Skouten, Joe Relidge, and Greg DiLoretto, why don't you all three come up? Shelby, did you want to come up too, or are you even still here? All right.
This looks like a good plan.
Oh, I should mention too, before we move on completely, that Fred Van Natta did supply a letter to us with some information from sport fishermen on marine reserves. So, Mr. Van Natta, thank you for that.
I noticed we didn't have water washing cast upon today.
They signed up. They put out a sign up sheet.
Okay. Beth, you want to give us a quick rundown on, on this?
LC-26 is a joint memorial that urges Congress to support the title transfer of the Tualatin Project. It also urges the congressional delegation to advocate for the transfer and to obtain federal funding to advance the project.
Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Avakian and members of the committee, my name is Dick Scouten, Vice Chair currently of the Washington County Commission and a member of the Clean Water Services Board of Directors. And I'm here today on behalf of Clean Water Services Board of Directors and Washington County Commission to support Legislative Concept 26, the Tualatin Project Title Transfer Resolution. Clean Water Services is a Washington County Special Service District providing water resource management services for about 520,000 people now in urban Washington County and small parts of Clackamas and Multnomah counties. Clean Water Services provides wastewater and stormwater services in addition to managing flow in the Tualatin River. Clean Water Services owns nearly 25% of the stored water in the Tualatin Basin, including the stored water in the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's Tualatin Project and stored water in the Joint Water Commission's Barney Reservoir, both in the Coast Range. Clean Water Services releases the water during the dry summer months to maintain flows in the Tualatin River to protect water quality and improve fish and wildlife habitat. The Tualatin Project is a U.S. Bureau of Reclamation reservoir facility constructed in 1976 in Scoggins Creek to provide agricultural irrigation water, drinking water, and to restore stream flows in the Tualatin River. The Tualatin Project includes Scoggin Dam, Hag Lake, right behind it, two pumping facilities, and nearly 100 miles of irrigation pipelines. Clean Water Services, Washington County, the Tualatin Valley Irrigation District, the cities of Beaverton, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, and Lake Oswego Corporation have repayment contracts with the federal government for construction of the project. In 2005, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation Commission, John Keyes, encouraged Clean Water Services and other partners to think about Reclamation Title Transfer Program. Established in 1995, the program encourages the federal government to transfer title of facilities that can be more efficiently and effectively managed by non-federal entities. In May of 2007, Clean Water Services, Washington County, and the other partners in various boards, commissions, and councils adopted resolutions in support of exploring the transfer of the Tualatin Project from federal ownership to local ownership. This project has earned broad support from cities, water districts, the ag community, business groups, environmental interests, and others. And Senators Wyden and Smith and Congressman Wu have secured nearly $400,000 in the Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2008 to fund the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's share of the Tualatin Project, including facility assessments and environmental review. The Tualatin Basin Water Supply Partners have provided local match for this funding and working closely with the federal government to complete the study in 2008, speaking of the environmental review and facility assessments. And this assessment and environmental review are necessary before title transfer can occur. Hag Lake is a major water supply for Washington County, providing safe, secure, reliable water for homes, businesses, farms, and maintaining flows in the Tualatin River during the dry summer months. And the title transfer would improve our community's ability to address and balance those often competing needs by reducing decision-making complexity, improving flexibility, and allowing for more efficient management of the water resources that are in the Tualatin Basin. For example, during the drought of 2001, Clean Water Services needed additional waters to release the Tualatin River to protect in-stream flows. Securing additional water took nearly 3 months of local and federal cooperation. With local ownership, this decision would have been much quicker and simpler. Title transfer would also allow the federal government to divest itself of responsibility for the ongoing operation, maintenance, replacement, etc., for the project. local water resource agencies currently own and operate Barney Reservoir, which provides municipal water and river flow augmentation water for communities in the basin. So coordination of dam operations there could be improved with local ownership of the Tualatin Basin and Hag Lake. Local ownership could also offer significant time and cost savings for future improvements. While the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation is supportive of our regional efforts to manage this facility, Hag Lake is relatively low on federal priorities. But for Oregon, the careful coordinated management of Hag Lake and the associated facilities is really critical to our region's long-term economic and environmental health, State of Oregon. So on behalf of Clean Water Services, Washington County, and the Tualatin Basin Water Supply Partners, we kindly ask that the Oregon State Legislature join the chorus of congressional representatives and the municipalities, businesses, agriculture interests, and environmental groups in the basin to support the Tualatin Project title transfer. Locals' control of this key water resource will help Oregon control its own destiny and sustain our economy, the watershed, and the community. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Mr. Rutledge or DiLoretto, do you want to add anything?
Go ahead. Okay. Well, I want to thank you also for the opportunity. We are one of the partners in the Tualatin Basin Water Supply Project.
Just go ahead and put your name on the record for us.
Record, my name is Greg DiLoretto, and I serve as the general manager of the Tualatin Valley Water District. We serve nearly 200,000 customers in urbanized Washington County, as well as portions of the cities of Hillsboro, Beaverton, and Tigard. The title transfer project is particularly important to us as we work towards this unique opportunity to bring together not only municipal supply, but agricultural needs, as well as augmentation of stream flow. We've had a number of projects in Washington County where we do these things together as partners, and we've found them to be much more successful than doing them alone. So we're looking forward to the opportunity, and the title transfer will be the project that helps us achieve a municipal supply that takes our district out for the next 50 years to meet the needs, the municipal needs of the county.
Good morning. Chair Avakian and members of the committee. My name is Joe Rutledge, and I'm the manager of the Tualatin Valley Irrigation District. And he's the water district, I'm the irrigation district, so we don't confuse them. I'm here on today on behalf of the Tualatin Valley Irrigation District Board of Directors in support of Legislative Concept 26, the Tualatin Project Title Transfer Resolution. The Tualatin Valley Irrigation District is one of the original partners of the Tualatin Project and currently operates the dam under contract with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. The district has water rights for more than 50% of Hag Lake facility and operates nearly 100 miles of pressurized pipelines, providing irrigation water to 17,000 acres of agricultural lands and more than 500 patrons in the Tualatin Basin. Washington County is the third largest agricultural producing county in the state and is a critical component of the region's economy. We've been working, again, with the other partners for over 7 years to ensure the balance of the water needs for agriculture, cities, businesses, and fish and wildlife. During our discussions in the last 7 years, it became apparent and clear that local ownership of Hag Lake and Scoggins Dam and the associated facilities will improve our ability to manage water in the Tualatin Basin. In April of 2007, my board unanimously adopted a resolution supporting the Tualatin Project Title Transfer Study. If we can reduce our costs and protect our interests through local ownership of our facilities, we need to consider this title transfer. On behalf of the TVID Board of Directors and the Tualatin Basin Supply Partners, we ask the Oregon State Legislature to support the Tualatin Project Title Transfer. Local control of this major water resource will help Oregon control its own destiny and help sustain agricultural economy, watershed, and the community. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, too.
Are there any? Senator Bates.
Just a quick comment and then a question for the commissioner. First, Mr. Commissioner, I'd like to warn you that you got on your right a water district, and on your left you've got an irrigation district with these guys fighting over the water later, okay? Because you're in the middle. The only question I have, this is a great idea, the only question I have is, is there going to be any difficulty with maintenance of this facility if you actually do get control of it and take it over as far as cost of maintenance?
I could probably answer that. We've been operating and maintaining the project since 1980. And in fact, in 78 and 79, we were, I was actually a Bureau employee involved in the operation and maintenance until we took the operation and maintenance contract was effective in 1981. So we've been doing it for 30 some years. So, and the county and other stakeholders have Barney Reservoir on the Trask, and they've been doing it about the same time, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So follow up.
We're pretty big.
Oh, go right ahead.
Well, what you're talking about here is just taking over ownership, because you're already doing all the work and you're paying all the money, and you want to have control of what you're paying for.
That's right.
What a concept.
Mm-hmm. It's a small in scheme of the Bureau of Reclamation. It's really big in the scheme of Oregon and one of the most important.
I get it. Okay.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 26 dated January 4th, 2008 be introduced as a committee bill.
I'll need to move us to a work session, and we'll do that. And actually, we'll just do the work session now.
Okay. And, I reiterate the motion.
All right, good. Is there any discussion, committee? Thank you, Senator Nelson, for the motion. Any objections? Seeing none, then LC 26 is adopted as a committee bill. I do want to say thank you to you, Commissioner, and to Washington County, because this is a huge project and a huge advancement for Washington County, and I know it has been the easiest thing to get done here, coordination between us and the federal government, but it's really, really good work for that county, so thank you. Senator Starr, I know, knows of the transfer, and this project is very close to his district, so when we get into session, we'll have Senator Starr carry the bill when we get to that point. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next up, Concept 27, Century Farms, Don Schellenberg, why don't you come up and bring anybody that you'd like to bring up?
I'm going to have you and Bates carry this one, if that's all right with you, when we get there.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. With me today is Glenn Mason. Glenn is the program administrator for the Century Farm and Ranch Program. My involvement with this project is that I happen to be chair of the Century Farm and Ranch Program, and had the pleasure of working with Mr. Mason. I want to go over just a brief history of the Century Farm and Ranch Program so you get an idea of what the concept is, and then move into why we bring this proposed piece of legislation before you. So with that, I would turn the mic over to Mr. Mason.
Welcome, Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. In 1958, on the eve of Oregon Centennial Celebrations, the Oregon Century Farm and Ranch Program was formed to recognize those families that have continuously worked the same farm without interruption for over 100 years. Since that time, we have placed 1,075 farms and ranches throughout almost all of Oregon on that roster. Every year, we are surprised that more and more farmers and ranchers seek that nomination. Every year at the state fair, when we award these presentations and the families are recognized, we become more and more convinced that the basis of our rich agricultural history is based on family farms. Katie Koba of the Oregon Department of Agriculture very often cites that over 95% of all the farms and ranches in Oregon are still family owned. And so we are proud to be a part of that recognition program for families that have persevered and persisted and take great pride in maintaining their family farms for a century or more. As you well know, our state's history is well steeped in agriculture. In 1850, donation land claims encouraged people that were already here to stake out 640 acres. Between 1850 and 1855, over 35,000 families came to Oregon as a result of this encouragement to come to farm in the rich Willamette, Umpqua, Rogue River valleys. After that period of time, the farmers continue to work toward the coast, up into the upper regions of the valleys, and over finally into eastern Oregon. So we have a rich tradition of agriculture in our area. Sometimes, though, we take many things for granted. We have food on our table, the wool that makes the clothes that we wear, the Christmas tree that we just decorated, the nursery stock that we plant in our yards and the lawns that we have in our front and back. Sometimes we forget that it is the farmers and ranchers of the state of Oregon that make that possible. So the Oregon Century Farm and Ranch Program is proud to be one of those bodies that stops for a moment every year at least to say thank you to all of those farmers and ranchers, and particularly to those families that have been working for 100 years or more on the same property on our behalf. Several years ago, as we began to think about the sesquicentennial that you will all be celebrating in next year, 2009, we decided that perhaps it is time to take stock of, are there families that have worked 150 years? And to our amazement, of the 1,075 families that we have on our roster already, some 400 or more will have their roots directly connected to prior to 1859 here in the state of Oregon. And so this year, we are inaugurating a new program on February 14th, Statehood Day. We will be acknowledging the first 14 families that have submitted applications, recognizing them as sesquicentennial farmers and ranchers in the state of Oregon. LC 27 is a concurrent resolution that allows us, the state of Oregon, to stop for a moment publicly and say thank you to those families. So we encourage your positive support of that resolution and take part in acknowledging our rich heritage and those people who day after day after day take care of us all here in the state of Oregon. Thank you. If you have questions, we'll be glad to answer them.
Committee. Senator Byrd.
The map you just handed out, I assume these green bars are numbers of Century Farms per county. Curious to know how you can get half the farms.
Because some farms spread over two county borders.
So in the counties where, like, it's an easy one down in Coos and Curry, you got 23.5 and 8.5. I mean, one of those 32 is in both sides?
That is correct.
Okay.
The same is true with Clackamas and Marion County.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Mr. Mason, very well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is anybody else here to testify on this? No? Okay. Then with that, I will open up a work session on LC 27. Senator Beyer, if you could.
Mr. Chair, I'd move LC 27 be introduced as a committee bill.
Committee, any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, LC 27 is adopted as a committee bill. When we get to February 14th is going to be a great day here for a lot of reasons, but this is going to make it a very special day. We'll be taking this bill on the 14th on the Senate floor and passing it. When we pass it out of our committee during session, Senators Bates and Beyer will be assigned to carry it on the floor. So in addition to going through the committee, if you have anything special that you're going to be coordinating for that day, it would be a very good idea to keep Senators Bates and Beyer in the loop.
All right. Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman. Appreciate your work on this issue very much.
You're welcome.
Good work, Chair. It's really kind of amazing. 150 years for some of these families. That must be, what, five or six generations?
And to have 400 of them.
Yeah, that's just amazing. I mean, that's just hard to believe.
Something very, very proud about for this day, man.
Yeah. Very stable. It's amazing.
Okay, we'll move on now to legislative concept 50, the water supply. Let's start with... actually, why don't you fill us in, if you could?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we actually have a new draft, which I think the audience has as well, that just came out today. So I'm going to distribute those to the members. And just very briefly, what LC50 does is establish a grant program to fund water supply feasibility studies. These would be studies for water storage, water conservation, or water reuse projects. The grants are available under this part of the bill statewide to local governments, tribes, NGOs, or other private persons. The bill also directs the Water Resources Department to conduct a regional aquifer recovery assessment and establish a mitigation bank in the Umatilla River Basin. And if you'd like, I can go over the bill in more detail, or we can...
Oh, I'll bet we'll get through it with people testifying. There's a lot of people signed up that want to testify, which is just fine. We'll get everybody in. But I know there's been a lot of work, especially in the last 2 weeks, from all the various groups into this matter. Tell us what you need to let the committee be fully informed, but don't go on any longer than you need to so that everybody can get in. I'd like very much to finish up no later than 10 after 12. And we will start with Phil Ward and Debbie Colbert.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Phil, for the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department, and Debbie Colbert is with me this morning, and I bet that admonition, Mr. Chair, about timeliness especially applies to us agency types.
Always does.
I'll try and hustle through this for you all. So Beth gave you a quick summary, Mr. Chair and members, of what the bill does. Essentially three things, and this is a bill that our department's been involved with the development of all the way through. Creates that statewide fund to provide feasibility dollars for entities who want to do water conservation, reuse, and supply projects. Secondly, it provides funding for a detailed environmental and engineering feasibility study for a project to recharge aquifers in the Umatilla Basin. And third, it directs our department, as Beth mentioned, to create a mitigation bank to facilitate the movement of water to where it's most needed in that basin. It's amazing, particularly this time of year, to think that there is a statewide need, unmet water need here in Oregon. But there is. And it's not just on the east, in the eastern part of our state, but here on the west side, too. There are folks in the room from right here in Marion County that have a significant unmet water need that you'll hear from today. Very legitimate, very significant unmet need. And so the main premise of a major piece of this bill, to provide funds for groups like that to be able to do the initial research in terms of supply development, is extremely important, we believe, at the department from a statewide basis. The second piece of the bill that I mentioned earlier is specific to the Umatilla Basin. This is a basin in Oregon that you will hear from the local community where the need is no greater. It's greater here than there's no greater need in any other part of our state. Our department has declared over 600 square miles of critical groundwater areas in the Umatilla Basin. We've severely restricted the use of water in those areas. In fact, in 2007, we only allowed 30% of the permitted use to go forward, because we're charged with ensuring that those aquifers do not decline further than they already have. This project, it's an exciting project because it would study and actually test the feasibility of recharging those basalt and alluvial aquifers using winter water, again, taken from the Columbia River in the winter during high flow time, where we're not bumping into those very important fish needs that we bump into when we attempt to appropriate summer water from the Columbia in this day and age. So again, the development of winter water, the total cost of this piece of the legislation is $750,000. The third piece, Mr. Chair and members, that we're talking about today is the development of a mitigation bank in that basin. This would provide a mechanism to move water around when and where it is needed. It would facilitate water transactions between willing parties. Water right holders could sell or lease water rights to the bank, and the bank would then lease or sell those rights for limited periods of time or for longer periods of time where it's needed. Facilitates a market. And we have examples right now where, for example, small cities in the Umatilla Basin that have unmet water needs, and this would allow them to purchase mitigation water from this bank and facilitate them meeting their needs for water supply. So, Mr. Chair, just to conclude, these are the bill's three pieces. We gave you an extensive packet of material describing these pieces. We'd be happy to talk about those in detail, but I think there are other folks on your schedule this morning that will bring some of that information. So if you want to bring us back later for questions, we'd be happy to do it however you see fit.
All right. Dr. Colbert, anything to add?
No, Mr. Chair.
Committee, any questions?
Just one clarification. We're talking about high flow times, and actually in the Columbia River it's a little bit unique, different than most of the other rivers in the Oregon, is that the high flow times, at least according to your chart, occur in March, April, May, and June. And it's just, you have an exceedance factor that changes whether or not you can actually draw water under Oregon law. But at the high flow times, actually the highest flow time, as I see it, is June. That's the highest flow of water. Just so that the community is aware of the uniqueness of the Columbia River in comparison to other Oregon rivers.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a brief addition to that. We've done a detailed analysis with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, so they've been our partners in this, of when we can withdraw water during those high flow times from the Columbia. And so we've come to a consensus with our sister agency on that, and the water used for these projects would meet those criteria.
Okay, good. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Willie Tiffany and Amanda Rich.
Good morning, at least for the next 10 minutes, Chair Ibaki and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. And we are very proud to be a member of this coalition. This is a very exciting coalition to be a part of with farmers and irrigators and cities and districts and nurseries and members of the Umatilla Coalition all standing together with the Governor's Office and the Water Resources Department to bring this idea to you. So, Chair Ibaki, we really want to thank you for your leadership on this effort, both last session and in this session as well. As you know, as you've heard, we've been working very hard. The bill has gotten better and bigger. We are now, as you know, our coalition is much larger. And thank you, Senator Nelson, for your vision and your leadership on behalf of all of our members in the Umatilla area. We're pleased to be partnering with the Umatilla to address those critical needs. And so I don't know. I don't think there's much else that we want to say. We do, at this moment, we do have a couple tiny tweaks that we'll probably want to look at on the language. The bill has gotten, as you know, much different and much better, but we've got a little couple things we want to take care of beyond that. But, again, we're just excited to be here today and be a part of this great coalition. So I'll turn it over to Willie to talk a little bit about some of the municipal needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and again, I want to express my gratitude and my appreciation for the other members of the coalition. I think Senator Bates alluded to the disparate interests in a previous panel, and not only are we working together closely with our agricultural partners, but with our tribal partners and our environmental partners as well. And I think we've got a really good product here, which is to the credit of you, Mr. Chair, and your hard work. We've been working over the last few days, and I think the department has some technical
issues, but other than that, I think in concept, we worked agreements across the board that I think all parties can live with. And the interesting thing is, as we were working hard on our proposal for a statewide program, Senator Nelson, to his credit, was working just as hard on the Umatilla piece, and lo and behold, they fit extremely well together. I think they work in tandem with one another to really build a statewide program and address a real critical need in a critical part of our state. With that, I've handed out survey results. We at the League of Oregon Cities surveyed our membership and Amanda's membership on types of projects that could apply under the criteria within this piece of legislation, just to demonstrate to the legislature that there is a pressing statewide need out there. And you'll see from the results of this survey that just in the municipal sector alone, we've got $11 million in projects on this list, and this is not a comprehensive list. This is a working document, and I'm still working particularly with the metro area on their conservation project lists and hopefully with the agricultural community as well on some of their projects. So I think we can demonstrate that there are folks out there that, but for a fund like this, probably could not proceed with some pretty exciting not only supply projects, but reuse projects and conservation projects. As we know, water is a scarce commodity, and those types of projects can be real important. Lastly, I just want to express my gratitude to Debbie Colbert, who put hours and hours in work in this, and to you, Ms. Petrino, who's worked very hard on this, and we very much appreciate that. We'd be happy to answer any specific questions, but given your direction, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Anything? Okay, thank you both very much. Katie Fast, Christina McNett.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Agriculture's value is found in water. That's especially the case in Oregon. Due to shortages in basins, however, and an evolving agriculture community, farmers are looking to add to their water supplies. This is especially true in the Umatilla, and we strongly support the Section 6 of the bill, but there's a statewide need to shore up water supplies for agriculture. This is going to be done through conservation practices, reuse projects, and storage. However, water supply projects are being done differently now than they have in the past. Due to changing society values and increased interest in environmental protections, these projects cost more to get done and require extensive environmental assessment before permitting. That is why we're requesting the introduction of the LC50 draft and the creation of the Smart Water Planning Fund to assist with water development while protecting resource values. Oregon has projects ready to move forward, but they need some partners, and I'm going to highlight just a few of those. In the reuse area, an example is Greenberry Irrigation District in the Corvallis area. They are partnering with the city of Corvallis to use treated wastewater to irrigate new ground for ag. These projects will also create wildlife habitat for threatened species and will help meet water quality standards for impairment of temperature in the area. On conservation areas, irrigation districts are moving forward to improve leaking systems through lining and piping of canals. And in storage, you're going to hear some examples of large storage potential, but we also have small storage projects that farmers are interested in doing on their own ground. They would actually be looking to apply for a few thousand dollars out of the fund, not meeting the cap of the half a million that's in the fund. On those smaller projects, they're going to be looking at getting grants to help with wetland protections and environmental feasibility. There are also opportunities in Oregon to create partnerships with the federal government and through funding. And as an example, North Powder, Malheur, and Owyhee Basins have recently received nearly $150,000 to do water supply studies. However, they're looking for matching dollars to complete the work, and this fund is a great potential for them. The creation of the Smart Water Planning Fund and the passage of this bill will create more opportunities in the future. And I'd like to add on, finally, just some other comments that you've heard from other people, but I think this is a very exciting coalition and probably one of the most powerful that I've worked with in my career, because you do have agriculture and the cities and the tribal interests sitting around one table, and we're not fighting about water like many times happens, but we're actually looking at how there can be water supplies available for everyone, and that includes habitat and fisheries. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but there's a specific project that I'm very excited for you to hear about.
Good morning, members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which is a trade association of irrigation districts. And you will hear from some folks in the Umatilla, including one of my district directors, Mike Wick, with a district out there, about that project. But I think Katie and I wanted to also highlight the importance of the overall statewide policy that's contemplated in LC 50. And but for something like funds in LC 50, some of these projects would never make it much further. And my job today really is to introduce Dave Bielenberg, who is a farmer out of the Silverton area. He is the elected board chair of the East Valley Water District and represents one small project, large in their context, but a smaller project that would benefit from the concepts in LC 50. And with that, I'll turn it to Dave and I'll pass out his exhibit.
Welcome, Mr. Bielenberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dave Bielenberg, Chairman of the East Valley Water District. Our district includes farms in the northeast part of Marion and South Clackamas counties, including communities of Silverton, Mount Angel, and Mulwala. I'm here to support LC 50 and to thank the committee, and especially Chairman Ivakian specifically, for continuing to shepherd this concept through the legislative process in February. For us, this is an urgent and critical issue. You might be surprised to know, as has been said before, that in the fertile Willamette Valley, with our abundant winter rainfall, we are experiencing water shortages. Our members farm within three areas listed by the Oregon Water Resources Department as limited groundwater areas. This designation is just one step below the critical listing. Some of our members have regulations put on the use of their groundwater permits. The area streams are already fully appropriated and also regulated. Last summer, the department regulated the Pudding River through 1968 rights. Now, the first time that stream has been regulated for at least 30 years. Recognizing water shortages as we're limiting high-value ag production, and because of the conditions placed on some of our permits by the department, a group of us formed an organization in 1993 to look at developing alternative sources of water. Since then, we have transitioned into an irrigation district, but 15 years and almost $750,000 later, we still have yet to distribute a drop of water. Meanwhile, the aquifers continued their slow decline, and streams are still over-appropriated. LC 50 is structured to provide matching grants of $500,000 to applicants for help funding the numerous studies required to protect public resource values. Some of the studies we have already done include impacts to fisheries resources, impacts to wildlife, fish passage, mitigation sites, water quality and quantity effects, impact to wetland resources and impacts to cultural resources, runoff yield analyses, 100-year probable flood analysis, and other preliminary engineering. Attached to my testimony is a memo from Phil Ward prepared by Barry Norris that summarizes the analysis already completed by our district. Also included in the memo is an estimate of the amount of work yet to be done, not an insignificant amount. As a community, we are at a crossroads. We need to build partners in this effort or abandon it until the situation deteriorates to such an extent the area becomes listed as critical rather than limited. At that point, the same issues, costs, and challenges still exist, but natural resources will have taken a hit. for us, this is not a matter of growth or irrigating more acres. This is a continuation of business issue. Thank you again for your support of LC50, which would potentially help fund projects similar to ours all over the state. This is a proactive approach to water planning and recognizes that nobody wins when the situation becomes dire. I'd be happy to entertain any questions, but due to the shortness of time, I'm sure other folks want to speak. Thank you very much.
That's nice of you to say. We'll never make my 1210, but I was trying. I was trying hard. But committee, any questions? Mr. Bielenberg, I want to thank you for your great work at East Valley. I know it's a tough job out there, and you've been waiting some time for the legislature to provide a little relief. I hope this is a good first step for you.
So do we. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. John DeVoe and Kimberly Priestley. And while you two are coming up, there have been a lot of thank yous back and forth this morning for the various groups that had a hand in this. And I'll let you explain, but I think Waterwatch might be neutral on the bill. But I want to thank both of you and Dave Moskowitz, too, for the number of hours that you've put in the last couple weeks trying to lend a good hand to putting together a package that's both environmentally good for the state as well as provides water. So thanks for all the work you've put in.
Thank you very much, Senator Bachman. John DeVoe, for the record, Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon, and Kimberly Priestley, Assistant Director. Water Watch endorses the promise of conservation and reuse projects and potentially more environmentally sensitive management of our waters across the state. The bill is currently in two parts. And before I get going, I would like to echo the sentiments of Mr. Tiffany and Ms. Rich as to the help of the committee, the assistance of the committee, and the committee administrator on working to make this a better bill. We thank the chair and the other members of the committee for their hard work on the bill. We would echo Ms. Rich in that the bill is substantially improved from where it started. We have been working with the department and the Smart Water Coalition, and we appreciate that opportunity. And we've worked hard to negotiate aspects of the concept. And as it's currently drafted, and assuming there are not substantial material amendments to the bill elsewhere, we would not oppose sections 1 through 5 of the bill. As to the Umatilla portion of the bill, we certainly salute the apparent change in direction from the OASIS approach to solving or finding solutions for the Umatilla Basin that we dealt with last session. We understand that the approach in the bill would provide substantial benefits to the tribes in the basin and to the region as a whole. It has been our understanding, and the representations to us from the state have been, that water for the Umatilla portion of the bill through the feasibility studies, if water came to be used, it would only be used in conjunction with water availability analyses that Mr. Ward referenced, and also in accordance with current state law, which includes OAR Chapter 690, Division 33. We would suggest a clarifying amendment in the bill just to put that sort of sideboard on the bill as a floor. If there is a more protective standard out there that we could negotiate with folks, that would be wonderful. And we would be pleased to work with any and all interests to address that issue and to craft appropriate language. That's our testimony. We salute the committee for its hard work on the bill and appreciate the opportunity to work with all of the interests here to make this a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Priestley, did you want to add anything?
No, just up here in case anyone has some questions.
Committee? All right. Thank you both very much. Rick, George, Phil Donovan, and anybody else you want to bring up? Actually, I was going to save them for last, but if you want to flip, come on up.
There's only 6 months.
Yeah. You see how much what I have to say about it counts. Just go ahead, set the order any way you want out there. Mr. Doherty, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Doherty, member of the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners, here today to speak on behalf of LC 50, which is a good thing. I've given you some written comment. I'm not going to read that. I just have basically three main talking points. The first one is that if you heard the comments of Mr. Ward, you know that this is a very important concept for us, which holds great promise and ultimately will produce great benefits for our region and also for the state as a whole. Second, we are very, very appreciative, gratified, and thankful for the work that's been done on the state side, from the governor's office to the state agency, Oregon Water Resources Department, the legislature, and others. We appreciate that stewardship very much. And third, I want you to know that on the local side, we have an equal supportive effort being put forth. We do, in fact, have a remarkable degree of consensus support behind this, a coalition which has come together. There are three main entities that are leads within the coalition: the Critical Groundwater Task Force that the Board of Commissioners appointed and which has been working for 4 years now, chaired by Kent Madison to my right, and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, represented today by Board of Trustee member Bill Quimps, and the spokesmen who are going to be here for us today have the substantive matters to share with you. The third one is the Western Irrigation District, represented today, I think, by Bob Levy. So I'm going to defer to them. And thank you very much for your attention. I would just soon not have questions, if you don't mind.
I think we can accommodate that.
You're asking, aren't you?
I'd run now. Get up and go.
You can tell who you like your people are.
Thank you. Mr. Madison.
Chair Vaughan and members of the committee, I'm Kent Madison of Madison Farms, and I am the chairman of the Groundwater Task Force. We were appointed by the commissioners 4 years ago to try to solve our groundwater problems in a cooperative fashion within our basin, which I was also a member of the Umatilla Basin Project Steering Committee in the early 80s that was tasked with solving our surface water problems within the basin through a federal program, which we have done and have had tremendous success off of that. So it's encouraging for me to see the LC 50 language, both parts of it, the 1 through 5 and the section 6 of it. On the to address the 1 through 5 section of it, I have done AR and ASR technology on my own farm and have funded those studies by myself at the tune of about $200,000. So it's encouraging to see a bill come on that would allow other people to access these funds in the future. It would be really nice if you could make it retroactive to us that have already spent the money, but we won't ask for everything. But anyway, it's great to see that you're allowing that kind of technology to move within the state and to help fund that, because it is extremely expensive to fund the studies that are needed for these technologies. The technologies that we're talking about is aquifer recovery, or excuse me, artificial recharge on aquifer storage and recovery, which are the key components to the Section 6 portion of the LC6 draft legislation. And I want to emphasize that is not pie-in-the-sky technology. We are currently doing that on our place and on a neighbor's place on a large scale, and has been extremely successful. And other than the studies, it's been really quite economical to do. And keep in mind that us in agricultural, private sector agricultural, generally does what's the cheapest thing to do, because that's the most economical thing to do. And that's why when we've looked at and developed the Umatilla Basin concept here and the assessment concept, we have looked at what is the cheapest alternative, what's the least cost to the taxpayer, what's the least cost to us as operators of the system, and what's the least costly to own it and to operate it. And we believe that is definitely part of that bill. The Umatilla Regional Aquifer Recovery Project will produce enough water at its complete build-out to replace that 60% shortage that was talked about earlier, in earlier testimony from Phil Ward. You know, it's very feasible. It's currently being used on private stuff. And If you have the opportunity to send your staff or even yourselves, OSU and OWRD is having a one-day symposium at the OSU campus on AR and ASR technology in Oregon on February 28th, and I would highly recommend that either yourselves or staff members, I realize that's probably the last day of the session, but if you or your staff members can get there, it'll be a great educational program to see the power and the tool associated with AR and ASR. With that, I'll ask if you have any questions.
Very good. Unless they're burning, let's not. Mr. Madison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Bob Levy and Phil Donovan, bring up whoever you want to bring up. Is there anybody else out there that wanted to testify? No. Very good. Mr. Levy, why don't you start when you get up?
Chairman of Occune and members of the committee, my name is Bob Levy. I'm the chairman of the Westland Irrigation District Board, and I reside in Echo, Oregon. On behalf of the Westland Irrigation District Board and our patrons, I'm pleased to testify in support of LC 50, specifically Section 6, the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Assessment and Mitigation Bank. The Westland Irrigation District is the district that delivers water to the County Line Improvement District, which is actually an improvement district that was formed back when Stafford Hansel was farming in that area. We've been delivering water to them since the mid-1970s and recharging their aquifer under state supervision. I'm pleased to say that the irrigation district is in support of the bill. We'd like to point out that there is now real consensus in the Umatilla Basin on Section 6 of LC 50. We are working together in support of this bill because it will start to address the critical groundwater problems that are now confronting farmers and ranchers in Umatilla Mall County. The Echo Meadows part of this study is a good example of the Water Resource Department's vision on how we're going to recharge that area. Our goal is to divert winter flows from Umatilla through our existing facilities and to convey these supplies to Echo Meadows. These surface waters will seep into the groundwater basin, recharging the shallow gravel aquifer. We believe this winter recharge will raise the groundwater aquifer, enabling local farmers to fully utilize their existing water rights while also benefiting the lower Umatilla River. If the Echo Meadows program works as well as we believe it will, our region's economy and environment will benefit. This is why all of us in our area support the basin defined project, and we encourage you to pass this bill. I can answer any questions later.
Very good.
Chair of Occam, members of the committee. My name is William Quimps. So I usually go by Bill, but it's kind of insignificant in this building. So. I'm a board member for the Umatilla Tribe Board of Trustees, going on my fifth term. Luckily, we don't have term limits. But it's an honor to be here today to testify. Usually, Senator Nelson and I are kind of button heads, so I'm very pleased that we're here on a supportive basis. Unregulated appropriated water in our basin caused our salmon to go extinct in the early 1900s. And the vision of our tribal leaders previously had the smarts to go work with the irrigators. And through phases one and two, we recovered that salmon. We have 5,000 salmon that return to our river a year now, one of the few basins in the Columbia River to recover salmon. We've done that, restoring salmon, for three decades, and we've kept our irrigation economy whole in the basin, which is very, very positive, the reason we have this consensus. Umatilla Regional Aquifer Recovery Project is the next product out of that consensus. This project demonstrates the level of trust amongst the stakeholders. We not only have the support of private owners to study the use of their existing multi-million-dollar irrigation systems, we also have the support of irrigation districts, along with the tribe, to study the use of existing federal Umatilla Basin Project water systems. Confederated tribes are here today to express our support for LC 50, Smart Water Conservation, Reuse and Storage Fund, and the Umatilla Basin Regional Aquifer Recovery Assessment. That's quite a word. The Smart Water Fund is an important first step for responsible statewide water planning. We are pleased the two legislative concepts are moving forward together. On behalf of the tribal government, I commend the vision and assistance of our local leader, Senator Nelson, Representative Jensen, and the rare and extremely potent development of consensus, which is unheard of in water projects, almost until the projects are done. Those leaders would be Dennis Doherty, of course, the Board of Commissioners, Kent Madison, Bob Levy, Mike Wick, and others. Dozens of citizens in the basin have contributed thousands of hours to this effort. So this legislative concept, I hope, can go forward, and I want to thank Governor Kulongoski and Water Resources for helping us arrive to this point. I applaud Senator Avakian and this committee for sponsoring this legislation, and we urge you to move forward. Thank you.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, Phil Donovan, Government Affairs Representative for Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. I was just part of the process of drafting the legislation, so only sit up here today to answer any technical questions that you might have.
Okay. And I don't think we do we, committee?
Nope. Session?
Yep, thank you very much. What's that?
Are we in work session?
We are now in work session. If I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 50 introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Is there any objection to adopting LC 50 as a committee bill? Seeing none, LC 50 is adopted as a committee bill. You can go. I'm going to say something really quick, but thanks. I wanted to, well, as he's leaving, I wanted to thank Senator Beyer for his leadership over the last several sessions on water issues, as well as Senator Nelson, Senator Bates, and on the House side, especially Representative Jensen and Roebland, because some of that effort over the last two sessions has led to us being able to get this done today. And also just to let folks know that we view this as a first step, not a last step, in addressing the water supply needs of the state of Oregon, and that we'll continue going down this road with a good balance between what the municipalities and the farmers and the residents need, balanced against the environmental protection for the fish and the habitats and the streams. And so thank you to those folks, and also to Mr. Ward and Dr. Colbert for your really monumental efforts in making sure that this bill came out like it did. When we get to session, Senator Nelson and I will carry the bill. And there may be some small amendments, because I know we're still continuing to talk about various pieces, but don't anticipate any significant amendments. And then lastly, thanks to Ms. Petrino and Mr. Estabrook in my office for keeping everybody on the same page and organized and getting us to this point. And with that, we are adjourned.